The next case on our calendar is 06-2096, James G. Jackson versus the City of Columbus. Ms. Gildy.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Eva Gildy. Together with my colleague Chuck Tickner, we represent the appellant, Chief of Police James Jackson. We'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. First, I'd like to thank the court for accepting jurisdiction in this case and hearing this appeal. We feel that the trial court and the Court of Appeals both misapplied long-standing defamation law in this case, and we'd like this court to correct that error. What if a police official heard a vile rumor about you in the course of his duties as a police officer during the time when he happened to have a personal vendetta against you? Would it be okay for him to report that rumor in an official report to the public? Worse, what if that police official had carte blanche investigative power to dig up whatever dirt he could find about you, and he happened to find, as part of that investigation, that you had sex with a minor prostitute and fathered a child?
Let me just stop you there, if I may. You made the comment, report to the public. I know you've argued that in your brief, that that's what this was, but I thought this was a report that was made for the mayor. It was an investigation that really was not about, didn't start out to be Mr. Jackson's problems, but his supervision of another person in the department. Isn't the question really whether a report that is, investigative report that is made for another official, here the mayor, whether that can then become public? The report wasn't really developed for the public, was it? Wasn't it for the mayor, or am I mistaken?
That's a very good question, because I think that's the clear distinction, the critical distinction in this case. The defense that you're going to hear from Appellee Rice today, and we've heard for quite some time as this case has gone through the courts, is that this was a report under his duty to tell the mayor about his investigation, what allegations were made, and what was done about those allegations, and in some respects, what conclusions were drawn about those allegations. And it was labeled a report to the mayor. But the facts show, and Rice has admitted, that this from the beginning, he understood this report was going to be a report to the public about the investigation, because the public was critically aware of this investigation.
Well, counsel, isn't that one of the justifications proffered here, that the public and the newspaper were aware of these rumors or things that were mentioned about the chief and maybe some other things that were contained in the report, and in an effort to be clear, transparent, and to forego any criticism of being clandestine, everything was out there on the table?
Yes, Justice O'Connor, that was part of the defense that Rice gave, that, hey, Carol Looper already knew about these allegations from Keith Lamar Jones. He called her or sent her a letter, I think it was, telling her about these false allegations. And you know what? Carol Looper wasn't allowed to report those allegations in the newspaper any more than Rice was allowed to report them to the public. For the same reason, even public officials are entitled to some protection for their reputation. Granted, the standard is higher. There has to be actual malice proven in the public official case. But yes, that was the point. And at the trial court level, we said to the court, did he have to go that far? Did he have to do it that way in order to meet, if that's the interest, the public interest that's at issue? And as the court saw in our brief, the public interest privilege that the trial court kind of applied, but the 10th District definitely applied, has four elements to it. One is that the defendant acted in good faith. It's the defendant's obligation to show that they're entitled to the privilege. Otherwise, actual malice applies. The court is well aware of the actual malice standard for defamation. I won't bore you with that. But unless there's some privilege, that standard applies. And if you knew that the statements were false, or you were aware of obvious reasons for doubting the veracity of the informant, or you had a high degree of awareness of the probable falsity of the statements, you're not allowed to republish the third-party allegations to the public until, you know, most of us learned that in kindergarten. You're not allowed to.
You're not allowed to republish them at all, or republish them without the way this was done, with attribution and criticism of the relator of that information and an accurate depiction of this individual's being untruthful and, you know, a former informant, et cetera. You know, so they gave the background to the individual who did that, made those statements, and said what he said, and there was no content that stated, and these are true.
The law is clear that the answer is no. You cannot repeat the allegations of a third party if you know the allegations are false or you have a high degree of awareness of their probable falsity, unless a privilege applies. The only way that a privilege can apply in this case or any other case, the public interest privilege, that is if the defendant did indeed act in good faith, and that's a critical issue here. At the trial court level, we spent 30 pages in the beginning of the brief explaining the background of this investigation and what Rice's real motive and intent was. And we think a jury is entitled to hear that to determine the issue of good faith. This court decided in McKim that that's a jury decision, whether he actually acted in good faith, whether his professing that he acted in good faith is true or not. And more importantly, after that, or equally important, the interest that is claimed to be upheld, in this case it was the government's interest in protecting its reputation. It was also, as Justice O'Connor points out, the interest that the public not feel like the investigator swept anything under the rug. The question then is the next step, the next element. Was the way this was reported, was this statement, the republication of this false statement, done in a limited scope, in a proper manner to a proper party?
Before you address that, could you get back to the chief's question? Was it published other than to the mayor?
Yes.
In what fashion and by whom?
It was, I believe, I hope I'm not misstating the record, provided to the public. A copy was provided to the public without the mayor.
Say to the public.
To the media. A press conference was held, if I'm not mistaken, and a copy was given to the public.
To the media representatives in attendance.
In the library of, you know, probably in the other room here.
By whom?
I believe, and I'm sorry if I misstate the record, and I'll have an answer for you in rebuttal, that a copy of the mayoral report was given to the media by Defendant Rice, by Appellee Rice.
Thank you.
Or a member of his team for which he spoke.
Also, as a preliminary matter, would this be a different situation if the report had just been given to the mayor? Are you arguing that it's the release to the public essentially simultaneously is the problem here?
That's a very good question, and the answer is yes, it is. It would be different. And Rice, Appellee Rice, is arguing that it's limited to that first limited privilege to communicate. The privilege that he's asserting, the privilege that was relied upon by the 10th District that was set forth in Jacobs versus Franks and A and B Able Elevator, that privilege is limited to one person communicating to another person within that limited interest, so that something can be done about it, as Appley has stated in his brief. That, in other words, yes, if this was a, and actually, now that I've said that, maybe not so much. I think if it was an internal investigative report, its sole purpose being that the mayor would then know what allegations were out there and have some duty to do something about it, the answer would be that's probably covered by this limited privilege set forth by this court in Jacobs and A and B. But he went beyond that. He included things in that report that were not for the mayor to do anything about. Supposedly, the investigation was over. These particular allegations of Keith Lamar Jones had supposedly, though not factually, been sent to the vice squad for further investigation, not to the mayor. The mayor wasn't going to do a thing about these allegations. He was going to do something about the broader kinds of recommendations about things that needed to be done within the department, but not this particular allegation. It was not going to be further investigated by the mayor. It was not limited even to the mayor in scope to meeting the stated purpose of protecting the government's reputation
Would this report have been available under the Public Records Act?
That's another good question, because that's been asserted as well, that because this could have become a public record, might have been a public record. If we were in a public records case, we were a newspaper asking to see a copy of it, this might be a public record. But as the trial court pointed out,
if you have widely known allegations, which was We just did not have the allegation against Chief Jackson. You had allegations of involvement with the prostitution ring and cover-up by several in the police department, did you not? So it wasn't just the mayor that there was the focus of this. And you, this is widely known in the media, and direct letters are sent to one of the media reporters. And why would not, why does the department have to wait for a Public Records Act to make an investigation public so that the public knows that these allegations have been investigated and disproved? Wouldn't that be better for your client than secrecy? Because they're all out there, and your client now has a report that says, we've checked these out, this guy's a liar, scam artist, and they've been disproved. Why is that defamation? That seems to be rehabilitation.
Had that been the result, had that been what was stated in the report, I might agree with you, Justice Stratton. The problem is that that was not how the words were presented. That was not how the allegations were presented. The trial court found, looking at the entire record, that what Rice did was argue for the credibility of Keith Lamar Jones in that report. He didn't just say these were the allegations that were made. He certainly didn't clear the chief's name, so no, that's not better for him that this was out there. This was an absolutely false allegation. Had an actual investigation been conducted, and Rice even asked Chief Jackson about the allegation, which I think would be a reasonable part of an investigation, he would have discovered that the chief had a vasectomy years earlier, and it was absolutely impossible for this to be true. So no, I don't think it's better for him that this allegation is out there, because this is a per se statement of defamatory statement. This is not a statement that maybe he's not exercising the right discipline upon underlings. This is a...
All right, then the second question I asked is it better for the public for a government to say, I'm not going to hide this and make you go through open records acts to get it. We're going to disclose it because all of this is already out there as accusations, and you need to know what we've done to examine it.
Had the report said this is what we did to examine it, and been actually, had that actually been the goal of the people that published the report, I might agree with you. Is it better for the public to know all of this? No, as the trial court said, the public has no legitimate interest in knowing the false allegations of a known liar. If these are scandalous allegations, I mean, beyond belief, even Rice didn't believe them. Why does the public need to know about that particular allegation? I agree with you that the public needed to know how this investigation went. They needed to know the scope of the investigation. Some of these big, broad allegations, yes, but this particular allegation, no. It's not better for the public to know this. And even if the public has a right, the chief has an equal right to protect his reputation from these types of scandalous allegations that the investigators know are false. To put those allegations out there in the public isn't fair.
Consul, I'm wondering about the state of the evidence. Your client was thrown out on summary judgment. Now, first of all, is the test that you're facing that your client can't get to trial even if you put enough in at the summary judgment point to show actual malice?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. I think what you're saying is the problem that he couldn't get to trial because he didn't put sufficient evidence of actual malice in?
Yes.
That was the trial court's decision and the 10th District. They said, we can't find actual malice because there's a public interest in learning about these allegations. The problem is the public interest privilege is qualified by the actual malice standard. It says, if there's a public interest...
I thought the public interest standard, and I'm not sure I'm convinced it should apply, but I thought it was limited.
It's very limited.
And it so states.
Exactly. It's limited by, not only by
the actual... It's called a limited public...
Exactly. It's called a qualified privilege. It's qualified by the actual malice standard. The point is that the first question is, does the privilege even apply? My point is that the public interest, the stated interest that Rice claims why he put these words out there.
I understand the battle about that, but okay. Could you speak to the level of evidence that you put in as to actual malice?
Well, the court says actual malice is, simply, high degree of awareness that the statements were probably false, or evidence that the third party was a liar. The trial court found that was easy, that a juror could find that, a reasonable juror could find that with clear and convincing evidence that the jury could find that. So the facts were there. Those facts were, if that's your question.
Okay, yeah, and you seem to argue in your reply brief that the report itself is a demonstration of actual malice, the overall report, not just these words.
Right, and the question is, does the privilege apply, first of all? Even if it does apply, which we say it doesn't, because the interest stated was that the report was way outside the scope of trying to meet that particular, the purported interest that was trying to be met. But even if the privilege applies, actual malice trumps that. The problem is here is this was a report to the public and not just to the mayor, which means actual malice has to apply. You cannot throw the actual malice standard out when you're reporting to the public. You want to report to the mayor or limited communication, that's fine. Maybe we can skew the actual malice standard slightly. But when you're reporting something like this to the public, actual malice applies. And I see that my time's up, and I will come back and rebuttal with your answer.
Thank you, Ms. Gildy. Mr. Siegel.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'm Brad Siegel. I'm arguing on behalf of Tom Rice in the city of Columbus. I'd like to sort of reestablish a conceptual framework that I believe the court should analyze this issue in connection with, and that's, under the public interest privilege recognized in Jacobs versus Frank and A&B Abel, there are certain circumstances where a party has a duty to communicate information or communications that would otherwise be defamatory.
Let me ask you about that. First of all, Jacobs related to communicating information to a licensing authority regarding medicine. A&B Abel is, by my count, only three people joined the majority opinion. The rest were judgment only, or in my case, a dissented. If I understand your part of your brief, you argue that even if Rice knew this was all false, and that's not the way the report relates it, and communicated this to the mayor with absolute malice, he was privileged to do so.
Now, I believe that misstates my position, Your Honor, depending upon what you mean by absolute malice. Our position is relatively straightforward. That is, where there is a duty on the part of a public servant to report on an investigation, that duty should include the ability to report on the allegations made and investigated. Indeed, it would be an absurdity.
All allegations.
Yes, Your Honor.
And when you have an allegation such as the one in question, which, if true, would have led to criminal charges against the chief, his dismissal as chief, all of that, wouldn't there be a duty to attempt to ascertain the truthfulness? In other words, to do a follow-up investigation. And where is the evidence of that in the report?
Let's see if I can respond to each of those points, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Rice viewed his duty, as evidenced by his deposition testimony and his affidavit, as to provide a full and complete accounting to both the mayor and the public of what he was involved in as a servant of the public, including investigation of allegations that were made that touched on Chief Jackson's fitness for the position. And the critical distinction argued by Chief Jackson's counsel between a report to the mayor and a report to the public is a nonsensical distinction under Ohio's public records law. These were public records. The public had a right to know what Director Rice and his investigators did in the public's name and with the public's money in connection with these serious allegations.
So everything that the cops here in town investigate, every salacious allegation that's made by anyone in town against any other citizen is the public's right to know.
Well, Your Honor, I believe under this court's decisions on public records law, under 149.43, these records in particular qualify as public records. referring to the Police Officers for Equal Rights versus LaShutka decision, where this court held that internal affairs investigations and chain of command investigations.
Doesn't that make the case worse for your client, because your client knows what I put in this report is going to be public?
No, Your Honor, I think it's consistent with his duty and his view of duty to account to the public for the allegations that were made and investigated, and in this case, to indicate specifically that these allegations came from someone who had credibility problems and indicated they were unproven based upon the investigation conducted and referred to the Vice Bureau for further investigation.
Well, now, in the reply brief, they excerpt a little piece on page 3 of what your client said. Rice stated, Keith Jones' description during the polygraph exam makes his statement suspect, but not completely invalid. The opinion of the polygraph examiner's opinion is that Jones did not tell the complete truth. That is not to say there isn't some truth in the allegations. Now, you cast this as the report is saying, well, you ought to, we got to put it in here, but we got to put it in here because Carol Looper has it, but she hasn't published it.
Well, that's one of the reasons why Rice felt compelled, particularly in these circumstances,
but
to account for these allegations, Your Honor.
But by putting it in, she can publish it.
Well, Your Honor, his report was to the mayor and the public to explain what his investigation uncovered regarding serious allegations against a public official. And it was uncontroverted that Director Rice felt it was his duty to account for these allegations, because they pertain to key issues in the investigation. That is, whether the ability of the police department or the willingness of the police department to prosecute prostitution violations had been compromised by the involvement of high-ranking officers with prostitutes.
Let me ask you this direct question regarding the question of malice. True or untrue, did Mr. Rice want the chief fired or wanted him to resign?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the testimony would be that based upon the results of his investigation, as summarized in the report, Director Rice was very displeased as a chief supervisor with his conduct of his personal life as it related to his ability to command and lead the police department and in connection with performance of his professional duties.
So he wanted him fired or now, to resign?
If I can continue, Your Honor, this court, following the lead of New York Times versus Sullivan, rejected the actual malice in the sense of common law malice test for overcoming a qualified privilege, precisely in recognition of the fact that when we are dealing with issues of public importance, I'm citing New York Times now, there is a national commitment that debate regarding public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, which may include, at times, vehement, caustic, or unpleasantly sharp attacks on public officials. And the U.S. Supreme Court's jurisprudence has recognized that there are at least two reasons why there's only a limited interest in protecting public officials against that sort of defamation. One, a public official has access by self-help to the media and the public to make his own case in rebuttal, as a way a private individual would not.
Counsel, I'm not hearing the answer to my question.
Well, I'm trying to, Your Honor, and I'm sorry if it doesn't appear that I am. It depends upon what you mean by actual malice. And my point is...
My question was, did Rice want him fired or wanted him to resign?
Well, my point is this, that Rice's belief that he had not fulfilled his duties the way he expected him to fulfill those duties is no secret. It's set forth in the report. But the constitutional jurisprudence, and that which was borrowed by this court, I would suggest, for similar reasons in Jacobs versus Franken and B. Abel, recognizes that on issues of public importance, overcoming the privilege should not be made to depend upon common law malice, issues of supposed spite or ill will or hatred or disagreement. Because as the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in Garrison versus Louisiana...
What kind of malice is left, then?
Well, to me, it falls back upon that which the court adopted in New York Times versus Sullivan and this court adopted in Jacobs versus Frank and A&B Abel, that is, publication with knowledge that the allegations were false or with reckless disregard, but applied to a different point in the spectrum, Your Honor.
With reckless disregard, did Rice, Did he or did he not have control of a group of investigators, including his former colleague from the Highway Patrol, Colonel Sturz? And when he had this allegation, did he direct them to see if they could confirm it in any way?
No, he directed them to interview the witness, Your Honor, who made allegations not only against Chief Jackson, but also against Sergeant Blackwell. And those are reported together.
Now,
the results of those interviews are reported in the other matters considered.
In what way was the prisoner a witness?
Well, the prisoner made allegations, said he had information regarding both Sergeant Blackwell's alleged involvement and the chief's involvement.
Well, the witnesses presumably would be this young woman whose picture is put in the report.
Well, Your Honor, the explanation for why no further investigation is contained in Director Rice's affidavit and also in the report. Director Rice's affidavit makes clear the investigation was winding down. The conclusion based upon the interview that his professional investigators reached, the former Inspector General of the State of Ohio and the commander of the Internal Affairs Bureau did the investigation. The information or the sentences you referenced in the June report about because he was not completely candid on the polygraph examination, that didn't mean everything he said was untruthful, is standard law enforcement wisdom, and it was word for word what Sturz and Dean had reported back to Rice in the April report.
Mr. Siegel, your argument is quite factual here. I guess I'm interested in whether or not there is new law that you're asking us to write in this case, or whether or not you're asking us to adopt what we've written in Jacobs versus Frank.
Your Honor, I think that may be a semantic difference, but I would answer you this way. I believe that this situation, the context of governmental investigation, as recognized by the Court of Appeals, is a particular iteration of the broader public interest privilege recognized in Jacobs versus Frank and A and B Able, and should be identified as such. But because of the peculiar interests and circumstances under which there needs to be an accurate, truthful, and candid report of allegations made and investigated, the question of how do we define actual malice as overcoming that privilege needs to be addressed. The Court of Appeals did a balancing of all the interests sort of test based
upon
Section 6.
I wanted to ask you that question because, as you know, Ms. Gildee argues that the Court of Appeals really has changed the test. This is a new test that it has adopted, and that it is in looking at considering the public interest test that the Court of Appeals wrote out malice. That malice is not really a factor. What's your response to that?
Well, the Court of Appeals did not do so, at least expressly, Your Honor, and I believe the Court of Appeals addressed that by saying, in effect, this is not a case where there is enough evidence of malice to go to a trial. Whatever malice means in this context, it is negated by publication of allegations attributed to someone with a reputation as being a liar and a scam artist, and the conclusion that it's unproven. Whatever malice means, it's not met where you have that evidence. I would argue, though, that consistent with or in symmetry with New York Times versus Sullivan and the important public policy issues upon which that decision was based, it would be more appropriate to continue to apply the New York Times versus Sullivan definition of actual malice, but in a different sense. Not to whether the allegations were published with knowledge that they were false or probably false, because otherwise you could never republish allegations. For example, a reporter could not, or an investigator could not say, Smith said Jones did X, but I don't believe him or I've proved him to be false, without being automatically liable not to Smith, but to Jones. And that's absurd. That can't possibly be the reason. That in this case, the actual malice New York Times test needs to be applied to whether or not what was reported as allegations was falsely reported as having been made when they had not in fact been made.
Let me finish the answer, please.
Does that then require a modification of our decision in Jacobs versus Frank?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it would allow you to save the same definition of the actual malice necessary to overcome the privilege. In this context, it means publishing as if allegations had been made, when you in fact knew that the allegations had not been made in the first place or had reason to doubt that seriously.
How does the restatement of torts impact
the restatement
this
of torts is not addressed to the public official context. The restatement of torts deals with a report of under certain circumstances a party may be privileged to publish or republish a rumor or a suspicion, so long as one identifies it as a rumor or a suspicion, and then whether or not that privilege is overcome is a weighing of all the interests. In the public issue, in public figure context, that test is not high enough or stringent enough to further the important public policy concerns, as recognized by the court in Garrison versus Louisiana. It's in the public official context. This is a matter of First Amendment jurisprudence. The speaker should not have to go to trial and try and prove that he did not speak the words out of hatred, or have to try and overcome an allegation when the plaintiff is a popular public official that his disagreement, his vehement disagreement for the public official, wasn't evidence of common law malice. And it's for that reason, in New York Times versus Sullivan and Garrison versus Louisiana, the U.S. Supreme Court said the test of common law malice is not vigorous enough, the threshold isn't high enough to protect the important interests involved in robust, uninhibited debate on matters of public importance. And here we are, after all, dealing with serious allegations related to a high-ranking public official, investigated by another high-ranking public official, and a report to his superior that contains the reports of professional investigators, Sturtz and Dean, made to an experienced law enforcement official, Director Rice, who had been superintendent of the Ohio State Highway Patrol, containing their evaluations of the credibility of the allegations, a report of what those allegations were, and a recommendation for further action. Those are the same public policy interests, but writ larger, if I may say so, that the court identified in Jacobs versus Frank in a peer review context, or in A&B Able, where there was a report by a private citizen to a public official regarding allegations of possible wrongdoing.
Mr. Siegel, would you take the converse then of Ms. Gildy and say that the public interest exception trumps the actual malice?
No, because I still believe under our formulation, Your Honor, there is a role for actual malice. We are not arguing for an absolute privilege.
But if
what was reported as allegations were in fact trumped up or fabricated by Director Rice or his team and reported as if they came from someone named Jones, or even to an anonymous source,
but
that would constitute actual malice sufficient to overcome the privilege.
But you're saying there's protection against the actual malice argument as long as the report says, but this individual had credibility problems, we investigated, it's likely this is false?
Yes, our proposed proposition of law, Your Honor, says this privilege protects the truthful and accurate reporting of third-party allegations investigated in the context of an official investigation. And that privilege is not overcome by indicating that the allegations themselves may have been believed to be false. Otherwise, you have the absurd result that no investigator could ever say to his superior or to the public, these allegations were made and I disproved them based upon my investigation,
Counsel,
or I believe them to be false.
What led the investigators to Jones in the first place?
A letter sent to the mayor, a letter sent to Director Rice, and a separate letter sent to Carol Looper, which was then provided by her to Director Rice, Your Honor. And as I've indicated, because these related to prostitution, and the chief's potential involvement with that,
they were germane
enough.
I guess I'm interested still in, they went out and interviewed the person who sent the letter, and then what investigation did they conduct?
Well, he made allegations again, Your Honor, regarding Blackwell and Chief Jackson. The polygraph examiner chose to examine him only with respect to the Blackwell allegations because it's the only one that in the pre-polygraph interview he admitted or said he had personal knowledge of. Then he was interviewed separately by Sturtz and Dean regarding the allegations about the chief, after which they concluded, and is reflected in their April report and then adopted verbatim by Director Rice, comes from a person with little credibility, and we believe these to be unproven and dependent upon further evidence at another time. And they dismissed them in that fashion.
I want to focus on the actual malice. So you feel that reporting an allegation that is beyond salacious, it's an allegation of the commission of a crime by the chief of police of a major city, that that's it. They don't investigate it at all. They just report the allegation and don't investigate the allegation, and that would not be an indication of malice.
No, Your Honor, and if you're referring to common law malice, I think it's negative, as the Court of Appeals recognized, by the way in which it was reported. This came from someone with a reputation as a liar and a scam artist who isn't highly reliable. We have to view those allegations as unproven, but they have been referred to the law enforcement for possible further investigation. There was a duty here, and under the, or even if there was just reasonably believed to be a duty under the formulation in Jacobs versus Frank and A and B Able, to report accurately, truthfully, and candidly to the mayor and to the public. To adopt a contrary position, to have the privilege found or based upon dislike or distrust or a feeling that the individual under investigation had fallen short of performing his duty sets too low a standard. And in A and B Able, the opinion itself, for the plurality, the court said good faith in this context is not synonymous with, nor should it be confused with, common law malice. Whether or not the privilege applies is to be determined with reference to the occasion.
You need
the
to
occasion
sum up,
in
Mr.
this
Siegel.
Context is a governmental investigative report.
You need to sum up. In fact, you need to finish.
And because of that unique context and the absurd results that would take place, were this court to say that public officials could not report to their superiors and to the public then, because they're public records, regarding allegations that were made and investigated, would do serious damage to the public policy and the accountability of public officials.
Thank you, Mr.
to the
Siegel.
Public whom they serve.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Ms. Gildy, you've used your time that we gave Mr. Siegel. We required him to take more time than he was given, so start with a minute on rebuttal.
Mr. Siegel is asking for an exception to the actual malice standard. He is trying to get this court to set a rule of law that says actual malice doesn't matter when you're a police official investigating false allegations. Allegations, by the way, that you pretty much know are false when you started investigating them. The trial court, in fact, found sufficient evidence of actual malice, but then decided that because of its weighing of some absurd factors, it was going to ignore actual malice, evidence of actual malice. Was going to ignore that a jury would be able to find that with clear and convincing evidence. The 10th District assumed, for purposes of the appeal, that actual malice could be proven, but said, in this case, because we're going to apply the public interest privilege, we're going to forget actual malice altogether. The fact that this was in the context of an official investigation and a report to the mayor, we can ignore the evidence of actual malice. We can ignore whether, in fact, we'd be able to ignore altogether if he absolutely knew the statement was false, if he had proof that the statement was false. We could ignore that because the public had an interest in learning about the investigation. And to answer Justice Stratton's question about, doesn't the public have a right to know that? And particularly this argument that the Public Records Act makes a difference. The trial court addressed this at length, saying that the Public Records Act doesn't obligate Rice to put certain facts, scandalous facts, in the report. It simply says that if something is in a report that then, by the way, is not protected, as this court is well aware, there are several exceptions to the Public Records Act. There are several types of allegations that the public is not entitled to know about, and this is one of them. As the trial court said, it's that the fact that law enforcement records are kept out, are excluded, as they're not considered public records, that suggests a public policy that some records regarding unfounded criminal accusations might be so defamatory that they should be excluded from public records. And that's what we're talking about. This, even if we got over the fact that this was a report just to the mayor, which it wasn't, the facts show that it wasn't, the trial court found, as a matter of fact, it was not just a report to the mayor. In fact, the trial court wanted to reconsider but somehow forgot to, I'm not sure I can explain that, somehow forgot to reconsider what they allowed us to reconsider, which was that wasn't there some other way you could have done this? Isn't there some other way that you could have told the public about these allegations without repeating them? Couldn't you have said, these allegations were made, they were unfounded, they're still being investigated, so we're not going to repeat them to the public, to Joe and John Smith, to Jane and John Smith, that the chief had a child out of wedlock with a minor prostitute, because that's just too much. He's entitled to more protection than that.
And that's what you're suggesting should have been done, that those sort of things should not have been found their way into a final report either to the mayor or to the public?
I'm saying knowing from the beginning that that report was going to the public, he had a duty to be more careful. That's our argument, and that's the critical distinction. It's not nonsensical to divide the law between, even if this court wanted to grant this wide, forget about actual malice standard, applying to internal reports. The court mentioned a couple of cases there. Black was the statements between law officers, between them, not between a law official and the public. In Burks and Stidman, it was a statement to supervisors or a supervising body. These weren't statements to the public. And
so, counsel, would you have suggested possibly that there should have been one report for the mayor and another one for public consumption?
I'm saying that if Appellee Rice knew this was going to the public, he had a duty to be more careful, because defamation can happen. And that he had a duty to be careful about reporting things that were, he knew probably weren't false.
Did the mayor have a right to know what the allegations were against the chief of police?
Even internal police investigative reports are governed by the actual malice standard. So I leave that for this court to address in another case. But the answer is, it might be yes. He can tell the mayor in an internal investigative report about allegations, even if you know they're false, even if you've concluded they're false. But you cannot turn around and give that report to the public, craft the report for the public. He rewrote this report since the April report, so that knowing that he was giving it to the public, and he fashioned it in such a way, the facts will show at trial, he did that on purpose and for that purpose. So he's not entitled to the public interest privilege, because he went way beyond the privilege that he is asserting, which was to tell the mayor about allegations that were made. What he did was tell the public every scandalous allegation he had dug up about the chief, and the chief is entitled to some protection beyond that.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion. Counsel are excused. We have an admission ceremony following the arguments. Next matter on our calendar is the admission to the Bar of Ohio of attorneys on motion. Our procedure is as follows. I'll call each of the presenters forward. As I call your name, please come to the podium and tell us briefly why you believe the applicant you are representing would make an excellent member of the Bar of Ohio. I'd ask that the applicants please stand in place so we can identify you. At the end of the presentations, I'll ask Justice Cupp to administer the oath of office. The applicants will be asked to come forward and stand at the bottom step. So the first presenter is Dan Borski.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm here to present Mr. Damon Lawrence Ellis, to membership of the Ohio Bar. Damon is an individual of high character. We went to law school together, Capital University. He graduated in 2000. Damon currently practices in West Virginia and focuses on personal injury and civil litigation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stanley Okacheski and the applicant can stand. You can just stand in place at your chair. That's sufficient. The presenter needs to come to the podium.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, go ahead. At the podium. No.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I apologize.
You come to the podium. She stands at her chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If I may please the court, I am here to present Elizabeth Farbman. I have known Mrs. Farbman for a number of years. She is licensed to practice in Maryland and Washington, D.C. She is a dedicated servant and will make an excellent attorney to the bar.
Thank you. John Kennedy. Maybe he's trapped in the. We'll go to Mark Messabov.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I am pleased to offer for admittance to the court Ms. Joni Green. I have known Ms. Green and her family for most of her life and a fair portion of mine now as well. She has served admirably in the state of Illinois as an attorney in Chicago. I'm confident that she will continue to do so in Ohio.
Thank you. David Mancino.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, it is my pleasure to offer for admittance to the state of Ohio today, Mr. Kevin W. Kirsch. He is my partner at Taft, Tenius & Hollister. I've been working with him for about a year and a half, primarily in the area of patent law and patent litigation. He is presently admitted in the state of California.
Thank you. Aaron Glasgow.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Glasgow. I am pleased to present Dean David Pellucci, who has been a friend of mine for over 12 years. I've known him since undergrad. He practices in Chicago and has been licensed in Illinois since 2001 and currently owns his own practice, a successful practice in Chicago. He is a good person, a good lawyer, and he's a good friend to me, and I think he'll make a fine addition to the Ohio Bar.
Thank you. L. Frederick Williams, Jr.
May it please the court, I'm here to present Patricia Proctor, as she is my partner in the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson. Patricia is a graduate of Marshall University, University of Pennsylvania School of Law. She practiced in Philadelphia for 12 years as an associate and then a partner with Drinker, Biddle & Reith, and returned to her native West Virginia to join our firm. She's an excellent person, be an excellent addition.
Thank you. Michael Barnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I am here to present Mr. William Schemmel. I have known Mr. Schemmel for 2 years. We worked together at Western Southern Life Insurance in Cincinnati. He's a graduate of the Washburn University College of Law from 1994, is currently admitted to practice in the state of Indiana. I have found my work experience with him to show that he's a person of great integrity and great intelligence and understanding of the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Carl Souter.
May it please the court, I'm pleased to present Pam Smaljanovich for admission to the Ohio Bar. She is married to my cousin. I've known her for 20 years. She is a native of Weirton, West Virginia. She has undergraduate and advanced degrees from West Virginia, as well as her law degree from there. She has been licensed in West Virginia since 1994. She's also licensed in Pennsylvania. She works in the areas of real estate, and she's also had previous practice in personal injury, and she's also previously been a municipal court judge in Weirton, West Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you. Is John Kennedy here or John Gilman? Oh, good.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to present for admission to the court, John Gilman. Mr. Gilman graduated from Rutgers in 1967. He's a member of the New Jersey Bar, the New York Bar, the Washington, D.C. Bar, and Nebraska Bar, and he's a West author as well. And I personally attest to his integrity and credibility and ability to practice in the state in front of this court.
Thank you. Is there a motion that the applicants be admitted to the bar?
So moved.
Hearing no objection. The applicants will please come forward. The oath of office will be administered by Justice Cupp.
It's my honor to administer the oath of office for admission to the Ohio Bar. And if you'll, at the proper time, raise your right hand as I offer the administration of the oath. I'm going to use the word swear, but if you feel it's more appropriate for you to use the word affirm, please feel free to do so. So raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, and state your name.
I,
Hereby swear that I will support.
Hereby swear that I will support.
The Constitution and laws of the United States.
Constitution and laws of the United States.
And the Constitution and laws of Ohio.
And the Constitution and laws of Ohio.
And I will abide.
And I will abide.
By the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct.
By the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct.
In my capacity as an attorney.
In my capacity as an attorney.
And officer of the court.
And officer of the court.
I will conduct myself with dignity and civility.
I will conduct myself with dignity and civility.
And show respect towards judges.
And show respect towards judges.
Court staff.
Court staff.
Clients.
Clients.
Fellow professionals.
Fellow professionals.
And all other persons.
And all other persons.
I will faithfully, honestly, and competently.
I will faithfully, honestly, and competently.
Discharge the duties.
Discharge the duties.
Of an attorney at law, so help me God.
Of an attorney at law, so help me God.
Congratulations.
On behalf of the court and the Bar of Ohio, I congratulate you. We have a very strong bar in Ohio. We're proud of our bar, and we hope it's at least as good now that you're a member. Hopefully it's better. Congratulations and good luck. Marshal, please adjourn court.